extra special girl. He'll make this December a one to remember, the best and the merriest you ever did have. Everybody's waiting for the man with the bag. Christmas is here again. Good, he'll make this December a one to remember, the best and the merriest you ever did have. Everybody's waiting, they're all congregating, waiting for the man with the bag. Better watch out now.
This is WHFR, Dearborn.
Hi, this is Phil Mack, host of Thematic, and I want to send out my best holiday wishes to everyone.
This holiday season, WHFR would like to remind all of our listeners that our online store is ready to serve your gift-giving needs for that loyal listener on your list. Our online store is packed full of WHFR logo items that make great gifts. We have t-shirts, hats, sweatshirts, mugs, and so much more. Best of all, not only will you be showing your support for our station, but a percentage of every sale helps WHFR continue making waves. So log on and check out our online store today at www.whfr.fm and click the link Shop WHFR on the right of the page. Be sure to continue checking out our website and Facebook page for special discounts and holiday shipping times. And from all of us here at WHFR, have a wonderful holiday season.
Hey parents, do kids think you're out of touch because of the way you dress?
Yes.
Well, say hello to instant style with Fashion On. Just spray Fashion On whatever you're wearing and look cool in an instant. Turn orthopedic shoes into vintage high tops, pleated khakis into skinny jeans. Even clip-on ties become fly gold chains. Just spray, let it dry, and presto.
What about my fanny pack?
You mean your hip MP3 player?
Wow.
What about my bifocals?
You mean your hot pink shutter shades?
Hey, I can't see.
But your kids can see you, and trust me, they see fashion.
Thanks, Fashion On.
Fashion On is not available in stores because it doesn't exist. But that's okay. You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Because kids in foster care don't need perfection. They need you. For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUsKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt Us Kids, and the Ad Council.
Are you looking for a real degree that's going to prepare you for the future? Then listen up. The Alternative Energy Technology degree is great for students looking to prepare themselves for a career in a new generation of green jobs. Students will learn about renewable energy and promoting and practicing of energy efficiency. If you're interested in more information about this degree or any of the other degrees here at HFCC, please call 1-800-585-HFCC or visit them online at www.hfcc.edu.
Every Thursday on the Motor Live Drive at 5, we bring you the best music in Detroit. Live and unadulterated. Rock, blues, jazz, soul, indie pop, singer-songwriters, all with a uniquely Detroit attitude. That's Thursday at 5 o'clock, or check out myspace.com/MotorLiveDrive/blog for a list of all our podcasts and link to those shows. Motor, we're live every week.
Hello, everybody. This is Smiling Dave wishing you a happy holiday season. Remember to share the love by sharing a cab. Be safe.
Disclaimer: this show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our board of trustees, or students.
Hello, I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for downloading this episode of Philosophy Talk. Your support helps keep Philosophy Talk on the air and online.
We appreciate your support.
And as always, thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
We're continuing conversations that began down the road at Stanford University. There at Philosophy Corner is the philosophy department where Ken and I are professors.
And our conversation today is about forgiving and forgetting.
Never forget, Ken. Never forget. But forgive. That's often a good thing. It's a different thing entirely than forgetting. When somebody wrongs us, negative emotions can eat away at us. They may do more harm than the original transgression. If we let go of our anger and resentment, we experience healing and reconciliation. Those are good things.
That all sounds very good, John. But, you know, sometimes forgiving, I don't think it's called for. Suppose somebody does me some terrible wrong and is totally unrepentant about it. Why should I forgive that kind of person?
Well, maybe you shouldn't. But when you forgive, you don't do it for their sake. You do it for your own sake, for the sake of your own mental health.
But letting go of my anger and all that won't do me any good if the person is just going to turn around and do it again. I mean, unless they do something to really deserve my forgiveness, I'd be a fool to forgive them.
Well, I'm not denying that. There are times when you shouldn't forgive. Sometimes forgiveness would be so totally self-defeating. And sometimes it wouldn't do anything for your long-term mental health.
So you agree with me that forgiveness is sometimes just undeserved?
Well, not quite, because I don't think it's really a matter of what someone deserves. It's not a matter of desert. It's a gift. There's nothing a person can do to deserve forgiveness. Forgiveness is a gift by the person that was transgressed. It has to be freely given. You're never morally required to forgive.
Never? Really? I'm not quite sure I agree with that. Imagine a person who is fully repentant. They've resolved never to do the wrong thing again. They've done everything possible to make up for their transgression. What more could you ask? Why shouldn't you? Why wouldn't you forgive such a person?
Well, maybe you should forgive in that situation. But my point is, to repeat, don't do it for their sake. Do it for your own sake. If they've come that far, your anger's not doing you much good anymore, is it?
Yeah, but it's not just a matter of you. I mean, we criticize people for being too unforgiving. I mean, if you can't bring yourself to forgive somebody who's fully and sincerely repentant, I think there's something wrong with you. And doesn't that right there show that forgiveness is sometimes the morally right thing, the morally required thing?
Well, I don't think it shows that. Getting to the point of forgiveness can be really hard. If you can't get there on your own, maybe you need some help. You need a therapist. But being unable to forgive isn't a moral failing. You shouldn't blame people who can't forgive. Maybe you should console them or get them some help. But it's not a matter of blame.
I'm still not convinced. Look, suppose somebody does something terrible to me. Maybe they betray my deepest confidences, right? And I'm all upset. But, you know, they're repentant and they're trying to make it up to me, set everything right. And all my friends are convinced that he should be forgiven. Maybe they have forgiven him. I'm the last holdout.
Well, wait a minute. Wait a minute. I just don't get this set up. You're making an assumption that seems unjustified.
Well, look, all I'm assuming is that my friends care about me, that they're upset on my behalf, but they've moved on. They've already forgiven the person. They're just trying to get me to come along, too, and do the right thing.
Well, now I see what I don't like about this scenario. It doesn't seem to me to make any sense because how can your friends forgive on your behalf? Only you can forgive someone who has wronged you.
I don't know about that, John. Suppose somebody does something, murders my brother. He's dead. He's long gone. He's in no position to forgive. But can't I forgive the murderer on behalf of my brother?
No. You can forgive the murderer for what he did to you, depriving you of your beloved brother. But I don't see how you can forgive him for what he did to your brother. Only your brother could do that.
But what does it think about self-forgiveness? Where you've done something wrong to somebody else, okay? You've done something wrong, and they won't forgive you. Now, but you feel a sense of guilt and remorse. It's way out of proportion to the harm you actually caused them. Your guilt and remorse are eating you up. Despite the fact that they won't forgive you, it can be a healthy thing to forgive yourself, to let go and move on. Don't you agree with that?
Maybe it's healthy to let go and move on, but I'm not sure it's self-forgiveness. It's not like you can say, oh, I murdered your brother. I know you can't forgive me. But I forgive myself, so everything is fine. The slate is wiped clean.
I see your point. That makes, you know, forgiveness is a tricky thing, and there are lots of questions here to sink our teeth into.
To start with, exactly what is forgiveness?
Can forgiveness ever be morally deserved, or must it always be freely given?
When is it wrong to forgive? Are there wrongs that can never be forgiven?
And what about self-forgiveness or forgiving someone on behalf of another? Do these ideas even make sense?
We're going to start, however, with a story from our roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Esch.
We sent her out to learn more about the emotional journey you sometimes have to travel to reach the point of forgiveness. She files this report.
Forgive and forget, we're told. But what is true forgiveness?
True forgiveness would be letting go. But I think it's hard for anyone to do that.
Forgiveness is a thing you can either do for yourself based on things that have been done to you, or something that you give to somebody else who's done something that makes them feel less.
But are some acts so heinous that they're beyond forgiveness?
Yeah, you can wrong someone so terribly that it's impossible to let it go. And it may be a gradual many wrongings that would really hurt someone so much that it's impossible to forgive them.
There is such a thing as, like, unbelievable, cruel, like, evil behavior.
Well, it was New Year's morning, and I just kind of puttering around and drinking massive amounts of coffee from the night before. You know, the phone rings, and it's my brother, and I could tell he was really upset.
Everett Worthington is a psychology professor at Virginia Commonwealth University. 15 years ago, his brother Mike called with some bad news.
His voice was quivering, and he said, well, something terrible has happened. You know, Mom's been murdered. I went over to wish her Happy New Year and took my son, my 10-year-old son. I let myself in with my key, and, you know, there was just blood all over the walls. And I looked down at the end of the hall, and her body was laying there, and I covered my son's eyes and just took him out and called the police.
Worthington's mother was murdered at her home in Knoxville, Tennessee, in a burglary gone awry. A young man broke into the dark house with a crowbar. Worthington's mother was brutally attacked.
And he was very angry, and he, you know, had assaulted her sexually with a wine bottle and, you know, then had run around through the house, apparently, and broken all of the mirrors in the house. He was very guilty, could not look at himself in the mirror.
As Worthington learned the gory details of his mother's painful death, he recalls first feeling rage.
And I remember getting really angry and just pointing to a baseball bat against the wall and saying, I wish whoever did that were here. I would just beat his brains out.
But within a day, Worthington did something incredible. He forgave. He says in fantasizing about killing his mother's killer, he was forced to confront himself.
So whose heart is darker? This kid with the impulse control problem? You know, who's afraid he's going to go to jail? Who's angry that his perfect crime has been messed up? Or this psychologist who studied forgiveness for years and years and years, who's done marriage counseling, who's told other people how to forgive, but who's willing, after a day of thinking about this, to take a baseball bat and hit somebody in the head until he dies. And I thought, well, my heart is darker than his heart.
Worthington is a Christian, and having studied forgiveness for almost a decade, he was well-positioned to forgive. But that doesn't mean it was easy. Worthington says it takes a lot of empathy, altruism, and commitment. For Worthington, forgiveness is something that happens inside of us. It doesn't mean you can't hold a person accountable for the injury, but you can free yourself from letting the injury sting indefinitely. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
Caitlin Esch with a story of murder, mayhem, and forgiveness. I'm John Perry. With me is Ken Taylor.
And we're talking about forgiveness. Our guest today is Paul Hughes. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of Michigan, Dearborn, and he's author of What is Involved in Forgiving. Paul, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Well, thank you.
So, Paul, what first drew you to the topic of forgiveness? Are you a guy that people have to do a lot of forgiving for, or what's the deal?
No, it's actually a quite pedestrian experience. I had, early in my career, I had a falling out with a friend, and I was in Boston at the time, but living in Michigan, and I had 800 miles or so to think about whether this was a reparable relationship, and I felt victimized and spent all that time driving thinking about what's involved in forgiving, which, of course, then morphed into this paper called What is Involved in Forgiving. And that's really how it started, and I've been fascinated with the topic since. Many people have written on the topic, many philosophers, and there's a large body of literature out there now, 20 or so years later.
Well, you're the man who's written the encyclopedia article on forgiveness, at least the article in the Stanford Encyclopedia, I think. So why give us your working definition of forgiveness?
Well, forgiving is, I think, a number of things. In the event of significant wrongs, I believe it's the successful process of overcoming hurt or angry feelings that have been caused by and directed at the person or the group who did you wrong. But since wrongdoing runs a gamut from relatively trivial to catastrophic, forgiveness is also sometimes nothing more than saying the words, I forgive you, or forget about it. And if forgiveness has a political application, it may refer to efforts to bring closure to the perpetrators and victims of large-scale injustices such as ethnic cleansing or discriminatory legal regimes such as the apartheid of pre-democracy South Africa.
Paul, okay, so your focus, I didn't quite get a definition out of that, but it sounds like you're kind of focused on the overcoming, you know, of the hurt feelings, the wrong feelings, you know, in these different kind of contexts. And it sounds like there are different kind of contexts in which you might forgive. But is forgiving just about, John said in our opening, forgiving is about you. It's kind of a self-directed thing. You let go of these negative emotions kind of for your own benefit. What about the forgivee, the person who is forgiven? Does the definition have to involve anything about your attitude toward that person in particular?
Well, I think, you know, if it's interpersonal forgiveness is the paradigm case that we're talking about here, then if you've been wronged by somebody you know and you're angry, and typically it's anger that people focus on as the emotion that needs to be transcended or overcome, then it does involve the other person in as much as they've wronged you and you're trying to get past that. But if you're in a relationship that you hope to mend, then it also is aimed at restoring that relationship with the other person.
So
I think it has benefits for the forgiver as well as the forgivee.
When you forgive somebody something, there are different kinds of attitudes you can have. You could excuse what they did. You could condone what they did. I mean, is forgiving like condoning? Is it like excusing? What is the difference between forgiving an offense and condoning or excusing an offense?
Well, I think condoning an offense is a way of tolerating it and turning it into something that you don't actually believe is wrong. That's one way of condoning a wrong, or sort of rationalizing that somehow it wasn't really wrong. And I think of condoning as a species of tolerating. I don't think forgiveness does that. Forgiveness is a way of acknowledging a wrong and attempting to move past it. And as I mentioned before, I think, you know, when it's a significant wrong, it involves a process of overcoming negative emotions. That not all wrongs are that significant. So sometimes just an action, sending somebody flowers is show, or saying forget about it, does all the work that needs to be done.
We have this one use that's fairly clear. That's forgiving a debt. If I forgive you a debt to me, I mean an economic debt, then you don't have to pay me back. Is that just a one-off use, or is that kind of get at the core of what's involved in forgiveness?
Well, I think that that's a good example of forgiveness as an action, waiving a debt. It doesn't necessarily or maybe even typically involve overcoming any negative emotional states whatsoever.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're talking about forgiveness with Paul Hughes, author of What is Involved in Forgiving?
We're going to dig deeper when we come back. Who can forgive? Can forgiveness ever be deserved? Is forgiveness a gift that has to be freely given? Can we forgive on behalf of another? And what about the idea of forgiving yourself? I do that all the time, but does it really make any sense?
Exploring the nature of forgiveness when Philosophy Talk continues.
Sweet forgiveness. And that's what we're talking about today. Forgiveness. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor.
Our guest is Paul Hughes. He's from the University of Michigan, Dearborn.
So, Paul, I want to ask you a bit about the question of moral desert, whether forgiveness can ever be deserved and morally required. John said it couldn't, but I'm not so sure. So I want your intuitions about this. Somebody has done something terribly wrong to me. Okay, but he's fully repentant. He's resolved. He's really resolved not to do it again. He's actually taken real steps to do everything possible to make things right. Doesn't he morally deserve to be forgiven?
Yeah, well, my view is that forgiveness is a matter of choice, and it's more like a gift that's freely given as a matter of an act of will on the part of the person who's been wronged. I agree with you. I think that part of your concern is that if somebody has atoned for a wrong and done all the work necessary to be forgiven, it would be stingy not to forgive the person. But I don't think that forgiveness is a matter of justice, and therefore I don't think it's a matter of deservingness. I think it's much more a matter of the choice on the part of the person wronged. And partly I think that because if it's a significant wrong, only the person who's been wronged can engage in the work of trying to forgive.
I can agree that only the person who engaged in the who's been wrong can engage in the work of trying to forgive. But a person who's done the wrong, look, I've done some wrong, and I realize I feel guilty, and I do everything possible, everything within my power, to really make up for it. Suppose I do make up for it, then what call do you? What grounds do you have for withholding forgiveness? If it's a choice, it's not just an arbitrary choice. There must be some grounds for the choice. So what grounds would you have if I've done everything in my power to actually make up? Maybe I can't make up, but suppose I can't. What grounds would you have for withholding forgiveness?
Well, in a way, I think you've answered your own question. That I mean, the effort of will to try to forgive may fail. And if the person simply can't get past the wrong, there's not much sense in talking about the potential forgivee being entitled to be forgiven. The person simply cannot get past it. And
you think, is that because you think ought implies can? I mean, if I'm psychologically unable to forgive you, then that doesn't mean that I'm required to forgive you? Is that what you think?
That's exactly the background assumption I'm making.
So suppose, I step on somebody's toe and it hurts, physically hurts. Well, I may do everything possible to help them not be in pain, but they may still be in pain. So I think maybe I'm inclined to agree with Paul. I mean, if the person isn't in a position to forgive because it still hurts too much and they can't make themselves do it, that's a fact about them. I don't know that anything I as a transgressor can do can make it so that they've wronged me by not forgiving me any more than it's the person's fault that his toe still hurts, even though I've, bent over backwards to ameliorate the problem.
Suppose I take the point you're making, but suppose I give the person aspirin. Suppose I give them surgery. Suppose I pay them back. Suppose I do, and they're still anger can be, if the resentment is a kind of moral anger and has a basis, can't the anger be required to be dissipated by the revised moral facts? I don't see why you think there's nothing the perpetrator can do to revise the moral landscape in a way that makes the anger no longer appropriate. Let's put it that way. No, the anger is no longer appropriate. Even if you can't get past it, it's still no longer appropriate.
Well, I think it can be inappropriate. As I mentioned, I think it's a very stingy thing to do if somebody's wronged you and they've gone through to all of this trouble to either make amends or compensate you for the wrong, and you as it were nurture your anger and you use withholding forgiveness as a kind of weapon against them. I do think that there's some moral blameworthiness there, but I don't think that translates into a desert on the part of the person, the potential forgiving.
So you see these two realms. One is a realm of justice, has to do with desert, has to do with what's morally required, and the other is something more like emotion management. And as I'm getting it, it's just kind of a different subject. Is that right? And can you tell us a little more about how you think of it?
Yeah, I think of forgiveness as being more like, say, charity, which is an optional duty, if you want to talk of it in terms of duties. That if we have a duty to be charitable, it seems we have some discretion over whom to be charitable towards and to what extent. And that's the prerogative of the individual. And I think that gives a kind of latitude to the person who's been wronged or who's thinking about being charitable to decide for him or herself whether to engage in this moral phenomenon towards somebody else.
Okay, I take your point. Now, I want to press you on something else that you said in one of your writings. Maybe this is right. I don't know. My intuition's just boggled a little bit. You say that forgiveness, unlike, say, pardoning, say, is compatible, or condoning, you say that forgiveness is compatible with punishing the wrongdoer still, right? And that seemed to me a little odd. I forgive you, but I'm still going to put you to death. I forgive you, but I'm still going to put you in prison for 10 years. That seems a little odd. And what does your I'm the victim. You say I'm the wrongdoer. You say you forgive me, but you still hold me to account in the ways that you would hold me to account absence of forgiveness. I don't know what your forgiveness consists in for me. Then.
Yeah, I think maybe a better example of that would be a parent forgiving a child for some wrongdoing and yet punishing the child so the child learns a lesson. I don't know how easily that translates to, say, criminal punishment and those sorts of contexts, but certainly within the realm of domestic relations, that I think the consistency of punishing and forgiving can be easily seen in that kind of an example.
But in the kind of examples I said, you don't think it can be so easily scene. So it's kind of complicated? Is that what you're telling me?
Well, it is a bit more complicated, but I do think that they're consistent. We punish people, at least in theory, by sending them to prison for committing crimes. And, of course, it's a complicated theory of rehabilitation, retributive punishment, what we're doing when we put people behind bars. But there's at least some thought that this is perfectly consistent with forgiving them. At least on the victims might forgive them. It's an entirely different thing, I think, when the state pardons people. I don't think of that as an instance of forgiveness at all.
I think tell me if I've got this right or wrong. I think you're really focused on the emotional letting go, right? The letting go of the moral anger, as you put it in some of your writings, right? You can let go of the moral anger but still want to hold them to account in some ways. Other people, and I think my intuitions go with him, think that forgiving isn't just letting go of the emotional state. It's re-altering the moral landscape between you and that person so that you invite reconciliation, repair relationships, and that doesn't quite seem quite compatible with, so easily compatible with punishment. I mean, there might be some steps that the person is required to make the restoration permissible, and so serving some time may be part of it, but that's on the road to restoration. What do you think?
Well, yeah, but I don't see punishment as not also being on the road to restoration. Punishment is not infinite. I mean, punishment is a specific a negative sanction for a particular action, and if the point of it is partly to teach somebody a lesson or to have them think more carefully down the road about whether to commit that sort of act again, then I see that, certainly relationships can be restored or continued, even in the presence of appropriate punishment.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about forgiving and forgetting with Paul Hughes from the University of Michigan, Dearborn. And we've got Alex in Pacifica on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Alex.
Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I just wanted to, for my own sake, and I think on behalf of others, I personally have came to a conclusion recently where I never forgive and I never forget. You know. And the reason I say this, if I can go on a little bit further, is I know if a person intentionally is doing something with, you know, I hate to get redundant, with the intent to undermine, disturb, taunt, they know what why they're doing it, and it's a deliberate act, and they have to accept and be accountable for what they do. So by forgiving people, you don't allow the opportunity to prevent this kind of behavior from happening, which means the individual who is doing these kind of activities has to be able to deal with their own mental dysfunction, and it can't be pointed out when you're in the mode of forgiving people. It's like saying, you taunted me, you did this, I'll never forgive you for that, kind of behavior.
Alex, I understand where you're coming from, but it seems to me you're letting these people have a lot of control over your life. I mean, forgiving is for you. It's say, I'm let go. I'm not going to let this transgression bug me anymore. At least that's part of it. It sounds to me like you're creating a trap where you're just going to have to spend all your time being angry about what other people have done. What do you think?
Alex, I think it's an interesting position. I think it's a harsh position. And I think for reasons John's alluding to, that if you don't ever forgive and you don't ever forget, certainly that it seems to me that if we're talking about having some negative feelings of anger, resentment, disappointment that are ongoing, and negative thoughts about other people, it seems to me that that is a harsh position to take. I agree, it's a position a person can take. I don't think it's a particularly healthy one, would be my reaction to that.
So, but Paul, let me, is forgiveness for the forgiver, or for the forgivee, equally both? I mean, who's it for?
Well, I think it depends on the situation. Suppose that somebody has been wronged, and let's suppose you've committed a wrong, and the person you've wronged just can't bring him or herself to forgive you. I think that in that case, there's something to be said for self-forgiveness, because a person can be mired in guilt or remorse, and those kinds of emotions can become toxic and prevent the person from moving forward and achieving some semblance of happiness. And so sometimes forgiveness benefits the person who committed the wrong, even in the absence of forgiveness from the other party. Obviously, I think to forgive people is to let go of some of these negative feelings that can impede a person's progress in life. So the forgivee and the forgiven can both forgive. I don't know about the equal measure. I don't know how we ascertain that.
So we've got an email that's kind of at the opposite end of things from Alex. This is from Joanne. And she says, what if the wrongdoer has absolutely no remorse for what he has done? Should, or maybe we can say could, does it make sense for the victim to forgive him anyway? I mean, from what we've been saying, maybe it does, if the negative emotions of carrying around that blame are too much. What do you think?
Well, I think so. I think that there's a certain kind of therapeutic value in forgiving people, even if they're unrepentant. It depends on the individual, it seems to me. It depends on the extent to which a person is mired in negative feelings that were caused by being wronged. I think these are individual things that
Paul, this is where I think your definition is too narrow. He kind of misses the target. I think it can be healthy to let go of anger in all kinds of circumstances, but not, let's call it, deep moral indignation, which doesn't have. And it seems to me that an unrepentant person should not be forgiven. They should be held fully to account. Right, they should pay the price. They should be moral exiles. It seems to me forgiveness, real forgiveness, is not just letting go of moral anger. It's offering a moral exile, an entry back into the moral community. So it's much more dynamic. It's not about me and my anger. It can have, offering a moral exile, an entry back into the moral community, can have therapeutic effects. But I think you're focused on just the emotional part. and not the sort of moral dynamic parts. And so I think you missed your target. What do you think of that challenge to you?
Well, I wonder, I of course don't think I've missed the target, but I think what you're talking about here is a slightly different view that says that forgiveness must be tendered for morally appropriate reasons. And if it isn't, then it's either just bad forgiveness or it's not forgiveness at all. Now, I resist the analysis that suggests that forgiveness must be based on morally appropriate reasons, such as that somebody has apologized or the wrongdoer has atoned. I think that that then makes forgiveness a virtue by definitional fiat, and I just don't think that it is.
Well, lots of times, I guess this is on your side of this issue, lots of times we forgive people not because they do anything, but because we come to understand what caused them to do what they did. Of course, people in the free will determinism controversy sometimes pushes to the point where if we think everything is determined by past events, we forgive everything, forgive everybody everything. But leaving that aside, there is this idea, I think Spinoza said, to understand is to forgive, or somebody said that, somebody famous. So that kind of forgiveness where we say, well, you know, the more I knew about why this guy that stole my wallet came to be the kind of person who would steal my wallet, the more I was inclined to forgive him. That doesn't mean I don't think he should be punished, because punishment may be part of the social fabric that you just can't go around excusing people for it and so forth, maybe do him some good. But, you know, for me, I forgive him. I mean, if I'd been brought up the way he was, I probably would go around stealing people's wallets, too.
What do you think of that, Paul, briefly?
Well, I think that's a very interesting case, and I think that the way I would unpack that is that the greater the understanding you have of another person's motives and their circumstances, the easier it is to possibly mitigate the wrongdoing in your own mind, to see that not necessarily they were compelled to do it, but there were factors that perhaps you didn't see at first blush that either do some amount of excusing or at least make the wrong seem somewhat less serious.
And, of course, it can work the other way around, too. I mean, you may have your default assumption may that a person had some reason for doing what they did, and if you knew it, you might understand them better, and then you find out, no, they actually don't. They're just an SOB that did it for no good reason at all.
See, that sounds a little bit different from forgiving to me. That sounds like re-seeing the moral significance of what they did. What you thought was an intentional, brutal one act was something else, and so it's not really appropriate to see it in the same way that you did when you were full of moral rage or something like that. That doesn't quite sound like forgiving to me. What do you think? I'll just really briefly.
Yeah, I see your point. I can. I think that's an interesting observation, that it does seem to stray from mainstream understandings of forgiveness. It's more as if you're moving toward a fuller picture of what happened and reassessing what actually happened, and maybe even coming to the conclusion that what you thought was a horrible wrong or a serious wrong really was quite something else. And that doesn't any longer sound like a process of forgiving somebody, more a process of getting more facts or more information
right
about what they did.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're asking what it takes to forgive and forget with Paul Hughes, author of What is Involved in Forgiving.
In our final segment, we'll focus on the limits of forgiveness. When is it wrong to forgive? Are there some wrongs that can never be forgiven? Can forgiveness sometimes do more harm than good?
Probing the limits of forgiveness when Philosophy Talk continues.
Siren seems to be the hardest word.
Why is it that sorry seems to be such a hard word? We're a couple of Stanford professors, and we're not sorry about that. Today we're looking at forgiveness. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. And I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Paul Hughes from the University of Michigan at Dearborn.
Are there any acts that are simply unforgivable? Acts that no matter how sorry the wrongdoer might be, no matter how much better it might be to make the victim feel, just shouldn't be forgiven?
So what do you think about those questions, Paul? Are there unforgivable acts?
Well, I think that depends on the strength of the individual who's been wronged. As I've said before, I think that this it's a matter of an act of will, whether somebody can try to forgive. I think that I'm reminded here of a quote from, I believe, Desmond Tutu, that forgiveness is not for sissies, that it takes a lot of work. and that it takes even some courage. That varies across individuals. I think that in principle, there's nothing that can that isn't forgivable. But of course, people have their own individual limitations.
So let's get some more callers on the line. We have Dorothy from San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Dorothy.
Thank you. This ties in with, I guess, what you're about to talk about, and I find that the word forgiveness is not really clear. The implication is that if one says "I forgive you," it means that the wrong doesn't matter, and that one is expected to proceed as though the wrong never occurred. And you know, I think of like major betrayals or, you know, child molesting or something like that. Well, you know, it occurred and it matters. And I think that needs to be addressed. And what would forgiveness, or maybe another word would be better for that kind of a circumstance?
Well, right. Dorothy, they're asking who has child molesters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Paul, I mean, I think that's just an unforgivable. What would it be to forgive a child molester? So there must be acts that by the very definition, does it just follow from the very definition of forgiving that you can't forgive a child molester or what?
Paul? No, I don't think that's the case. These are complicated wrongs, and they're catastrophic in many cases, and I think some people are just not going to be able to forgive them. The victims of child molestation have enormous psychological hurdles to overcome, and I'm not so confident that they'd be able to. But I don't see in principle a reason why that, you know, human beings do some amazing things, and they often have the strength to overcome some incredible wrongs that were done to them. And so I think as a matter of empirical fact that it depends on the strength of the individual who's been wronged.
Now Paul's pushing kind of a transgressee or victim-centered conception of forgiveness, and I do want to point out that the dictionary seems to be on his side. The dictionary says to forgive is to stop feeling angry or resentful towards someone for an offense, flaw, or a mistake. So there's no parameter in there for the thing being unforgivable. Now that leads, however, to a difficulty which an emailer has just pointed out. This is Reggie Wilkinson. And he says, I'd like to hear the perspective on the role of forgiveness after there is no possibility of communication due to death or circumstance between the victim and perpetrator. It would seem to me that if the purpose of forgiveness is radically different between the victim and perpetrator in this kind of case, to the point where they almost deserve two different names. Well, I mean, just take the case of death. I mean, if it's a matter of the person who was transgressed ceasing to feel angry, then you say, well, he dies, he ceases to feel angry, so you're automatically forgiven. Or you might say, well, no, he was angry up to his moment of death, so there's no longer any possibility of being forgiven. But don't we think there is some possibility of forgiveness even after the person was against is dead? So is this kind of subjective, victim-oriented definition of forgiveness totally adequate?
Well, I'd be surprised if any definition is totally adequate in something as complicated as this. And that's why philosophers get engaged with these kinds of things. But
that's why we get paid the big bucks.
That's exactly right. But I think the example is puzzling to me. I think that it's possible to forgive somebody who wronged you who is now dead. And obviously, I think that people who are dead cannot forgive anybody if forgiveness involves this sort of emotional transformation. I do think the question's a good one about it can't simply be the cessation of negative feelings. There are lots of ways in which people can go about extirpating anger or hatred, and those are not all going to count as forgiveness.
So this is really complicated stuff, because on the one hand, it seems to me the idea that forgiveness is about restoring moral community. Well, we do forgive dead wrongdoers, but we don't restore moral community with them. That seems mostly focused on us, right? But the idea that the dead who were wronged can't forgive, it goes back to an example we talked about at the opening. It seems to me, you know, on behalf of my murdered brother, I could forgive the victim, not just for taking away my brother, but on behalf, I mean, the killer. On behalf of my brother, I could forgive the killer. Do you think that's possible or not? John thought that was a little puzzling. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's not at all possible. I think that third-party forgiving of that sort is, as I think John suggested, that people can be harmed or wronged via other people in their lives being wronged, so that if my wife and daughter are wronged, then I'm wronged in some obvious sense, and I can forgive the wrongdoer for myself, for the harm that I received. But I can't do that work, it seems to me, for my wife or my daughter.
I don't know. I can't do that work if they're around to do it themselves. But in the case when they're not around to do it themselves, who else speaks for them? Or are they just voiceless? I speak on behalf out of a deep identification with them that, you know,
it's possible, of course, to say that I believe my wife would have forgiven you. But that's not forgiving somebody. That's saying that, you know, I have good reasons to think she would have if she were in a position to do so. And I think that's a very different thing.
Well, now, in the intro, when we brought this up, we went into self-forgiveness. And we do seem to talk about forgiving oneself. So let's say I'm like St. Augustine, and I broke into a pear orchard when I was a kid, and I've felt bad about it ever since. And one day I decide, well, it's time to forgive myself for that. Now, am I just forgiving myself for the harm that breaking into the pear orchard did to me? It doesn't seem quite right to look at it that way.
And even if the victim doesn't forgive you, you can still legitimately forgive yourself.
It seems to me that that's possible, though I think the transformations are very different. They're all, in the case of self-forgiving, the drama takes place within the individual himself as the wrongdoer and as the victim in some sense. And that's a different dynamic than interpersonal forgiving.
I don't see how your two views go together. I can't forgive on behalf. Only the wronged party can forgive, you said. But if I forgive myself, I'm not the wrong party. And you said I can forgive myself for something I've done to somebody else, even though they don't forgive me. How do those two aspects of your view go together?
Well, I think it's consistent to say that people can forgive themselves for wrongs that they've done to themselves. For example, straying from a diet, refraining from quitting after making smoking after making a commitment to do so, or even just falling short of some moral ideal that one is trying to achieve. And then one, I think one can forgive for having wronged other people in the sense that one can move past and needs to move past for prudential reasons, perhaps some guilt or other feeling that is debilitating.
Ron in Palo Alto wants to join this conversation. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Ron.
Hello.
So what's your comment or question?
Well, a little story. I didn't speak to my sister for 7 years. And it's kind of an interesting thing, and I forgave her. And how do I describe this? I think you guys are intellectualizing and making table talk about forgiveness, when in actuality, it is an intensely emotional thing that's very hard to do. I've had anger that is so intense that it disrupts my life, and that had it gone on for some time. Now, what I'm trying to say is the forgiveness, in large part, is for you, because that anger that is just eating you up inside, it's wrecking your life, so you have to forgive, not for the other individual, but for yourself.
Ron, I understand your point, and you're making a deep point, and I actually want to amend something I said. Look, Paul, I really do believe you've missed something. I do think forgiveness can be morally required, in a sense, at least deserved. But here's another thing. Even though it's deserved, and often you can demand the things you deserve, you can't demand forgiveness. Right, so it can be deserved, but it's not demandable. And Ron's put his finger on why it can't be demanded, because it's always going to take often going to take some intense psychological journey, some very personal, very intense psychological journey. And the victim who put you in this position, even if you've done everything he can or she can to make it right, blah, 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 still cannot demand of you that you forgive. So I think it can be deserved. And you can launch this journey. You may not be able to reach it. It cannot be demanded. So what do you think about that?
Well, I think that's an interesting wrinkle on the notion of desert. I mean, I tend to think of desert as a justice-based concept in which people have rights and they're entitled to certain things. And that's the notion, I think, that's not really compatible with forgiveness, as at least as a gift, as something that's up to the wrongdoer to proffer to the person who wronged them. I'm wondering if your notion here of desert violates the assumption we talked about before.
I don't think dessert is just dessert injustice. I mean, it's not just a distribution of rights. I mean, I deserve...
Well, then clarify your notion of dessert, because it seems to me maybe violating the ought implies can stricture that we talked about earlier.
Well, that's why I said that's the puzzling part. It's something that can be deserved, but it's not demandable by the person who deserves it, which makes it different from most things that I deserve. Most things I deserve, if you withhold them from me, I can demand it of you. But I agree, so there's a complicated thing. That's because forgiveness is really complicated because of what Ron was saying. It's psychologically demanding.
We've got an email that adds some kind of a factual basis to some of these issues. This is from Meredith, and he or she says, as a defense attorney, I have learned about a small proportion of relatives of those killed through criminal wrongdoing who do decide to forgive. They talk about it as a daily practice. After time, many contact the wrongdoer. The prize for them is an easing of the hurt, or so they report. Most victims' relatives want several things from the perpetrator: acknowledgement, explanation of what happened, and genuine apology. This can sometimes be achieved through the aforementioned contact. So this idea of forgiveness being not just a one-time decision, but an ongoing project is I think, interesting.
What do you think, briefly, Paul?
Well, yeah, I think that is a very good point. A good friend of mine recently reminded me that forgiveness is often a work in progress, that we sort of inch our way to it, but we may not be, you know, a straight line. It may not simply be an act of will. It may take a good deal of time to accomplish.
Right. So, I mean, to Ron, do you have any advice? I know you're a philosopher, not a therapist. But you've thought about this a lot. Do you have any advice about how to, help people get past the point of not being able to forgive to the point of being able to forgive? Is there anything philosophers
have to add? Well, you're right. I'm not a psychologist. I could ask my wife about that. But, I think that often enough you need to just talk with people. I think that if you can get a better understanding from them of what they did and what they thought they were doing, that can at least open the door to trying to have a greater understanding and maybe ease some of the bad feelings that are occasioned by being wronged.
So on that note, Paul, I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been a great conversation.
Well, you're welcome. It's been fun.
Our guest has been Paul Hughes. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of Michigan, Dearborn. He's author of What is Involved in Forgiving. So, John, you have one quick final thought? Really quick final thought there?
Yeah, if you're going to wrong someone, pick someone who doesn't hold a grudge so that there's a possibility that they'll forgive you. That's a practical lesson I've learned from the conversation.
Yeah, pick somebody who doesn't hold a grudge. I still believe, we've just scratched the surface here. I still believe there are unforgivable things, and I do think Paul sort of missed the bucket. It's more morally complicated. But, this is a rich topic, and our conversation will continue on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is, as always, cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you know what? You can follow us on Twitter, and you can find out more by visiting our very active, ever growing Facebook page as well.
Now, Ken, if I'm right, you've already started us off on the blog with a blog on this.
You're wrong. Forgive me, but I will start it off
soon. Sorry, I can't forgive you. That's part of the deal. Anyway, you can also sign up to get the free weekly podcast of Philosophy Talk at our website, philosophytalk.org. Now it's about time to forgive but not forget Ian Scholes. He's the 60-second philosopher, and he is now going to transgress the speed limit of thought.
Ian Scholes, in recent years, the concept of forgiveness has been taken up by universities with forgiveness institutes founded, studies funded, and conclusions reached that forgiveness makes the forgiver healthier, and probably the forgiven, too. Forgiveness is a stress reducer. This is all well and good, but it kind of takes a starch out of traditional morality. There, you might recall, only God forgives. All you have to do is accept, and all of your sins are forgiven, which I always found a bit flawed. I mean, theoretically, you can go out and kill a dozen people, then accept Jesus and be forgiven. That doesn't seem fair somehow. Anyway, now forgiveness has committees and bureaucracies, and now everybody's on the forgiveness bandwagon. Self-help gurus even encourage us to forgive ourselves, which seems to defeat the point, doesn't it? It's one thing if a South African forgives the person who murdered her family. That's an act that is both startling and humbling. But to forgive yourself for, eating a bag of potato chips when you swore you wouldn't? Not much pity or terror there. And what about me? Because it's all about me. I got in a lot of fist fights when I was a boy, and yet I hold no resentment for those who beat me. Some of them became my friends. Some of them I later beat up myself. I've had girlfriends break up with me. I with them. I hold no resentment towards any of them as well. The girlfriend's attitudes may vary. The point is, in the scheme of things, my life is really too mundane to go around asking for forgiveness or bestowing it. Impulse and anger have led to relatively horrible consequences, yet those can be both forgivable and or forgettable. What's not are the little things. It's the little people that haunt my stunted forgiveness node. Thoughtless remarkers say one thing, do another, sandbaggers, backstabbers, rumor-mongers, behind-your-backers, butter-wouldn't melt on their mouthers, bad-mouthers, take-the-credit, do-no-workers, nosy parkers, shirkers, bald-faced liars, sneaks, snipes, the pointlessly rude, blowhards, bullies, the shiftless, the smug, the veiled insulters, the clap-trappers, whiners, nitpickers, loons, and louts. All of these remain unforgiven in my book, which admittedly is a small book, much smaller than the Bible, or even the bound minutes from the last meeting of the International Forgiveness Council. Still, in that little book, they all might be forgiven, had I forgiveness in me. But I'm one of those hold-a-grudgers, which is in itself probably unforgivable. I gotta go.
The Wisdom of the Ages, in a nutshell, from Ian Scholes, the 60-Second Philosopher.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2011.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research.
Thanks also to Chris Hoff, Merle Kessler, Dave Millar, Corey Goldman, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Templeton Foundation and from various groups at Stanford University and from the Friends of Philosophy Talk
and the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Earth and Sky.
The Higgs idea, if it were proven correct by experiment, would greatly simplify our picture, our basic picture, of how the world works. That's our job, is to make a picture so simple that it could be inscribed on a T-shirt of average size.
You're listening to Leon Letterman, Nobel laureate in physics, and this is Earth Sky's Clear Voices for Science. Dr. Letterman is well known for giving an elusive elementary particle, the Higgs particle, its nickname. He called it the God particle. He spoke with Earth Sky's Lindsay Patterson and explained the idea behind the Higgs particle, why he thinks it's important to find, and what uncovering the structure of the universe means for all of us.
Welcome to Earth Sky's Clear Voices for Science.
Glad to be here.
So can you give us an explanation of the basic principles of the Higgs particle?
Okay. First of all, we should say it's a speculation. There may not be such a thing, but the speculation has a certain amount of scientific beauty, if you like, and interest. There's many, many of the theoretical physicists, the physicists who just use pencil and paper, they claim and think deeply, they have proposed the existence throughout all of space of what they call a field, a Higgs field. It's somewhat like an electric field. If you have a lot of electricity around, say, charged screen, electrically charged, there'll be an electric field everywhere. And you can tell this by putting an electron in that field. The electron will respond to the field by moving. In a similar way, theoretical physicists have proposed the existence of a Higgs field. The Higgs field was supposed to, is designed to solve problems that we have with the structure of matter and really how our world works.
Why is it so important for physicists to find the Higgs? Is it purely so our view of the world can be a bit more simple and unified? Why is it so important? Why is this the central challenge of particle physics right now?
Well, it's our job. Our job is to understand how the world works. and to how to understand how it works in its most primitive fashion. Because what happens is when we have a hypothesis, for example, that everything is made of atoms and atoms are made of quarks and leptons, that's the basic structure from which we will obtain our whole knowledge of the universe, its origins, how it evolved, and in particular, how it will age, its progress over the next billions of years. Unfortunately, we can't predict what will happen the day after tomorrow, but we can, in a good theory of the universe, predict how the universe will evolve. And it was just the evolution of the universe that called into question our picture of gravity. There's something called the theory of relativity, which is an accounting for how gravity tugs on different parts of the universe and gives rise to, for example, our solar system with spinning planets. The spinning planets give you day and night. The orbiting of the planets gives you summer and winter. In other words, everything we want to understand about the world has to do with a model of the basic particles and the laws of physics by which these particles carry out their task. So the Higgs idea, if it were proven correct by experiment, would greatly simplify our picture, our basic picture of how the world works.
So what happens if we can't prove the existence of the Higgs?
Yes, that's a good question. It could be that we find no evidence for the Higgs particle. It just doesn't show up in any of these experiments looking for the an object with the properties that we've listed for the Higgs. In which case, many theoretical physicists will be very discouraged and they'll jump out of second floor windows. They don't want to go up too high because they'll hurt themselves. They'll be very discouraged, but the more younger ones perhaps will go back to the drawing board, if you like, to their theories and say, what other phenomenon could account for the complexity of our knowledge, which has nothing to do with this idea of Higgs. It's got to be something else.
So how likely do you think it is that we'll find the Higgs, or how likely is it that we'll have to start over again?
It's very hard to you know, make a probability. It's in a way, it's tossing a coin. But the majority of physicists go along with the theorists, and they say that the most plausible way to improve our theory without jettisoning too much of it, because so much of it is correct, so much of it works, so much of it makes predictions as to what will happen. So there are many things about the world we do know, and Higgs would fit smoothly into that.